Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Two guests this week, and two interesting conversations, I think, that you're really going to like. Tim Kawakami is the editor-in-chief of The Athletic Bay Area. Those of you who are readers of sports writers across the country know of Tim and his work in the Bay Area for multiple newspapers over the last couple of decades. He now joins this startup, The Athletic, which is a subscription model in multiple cities, including Chicago, Toronto, Cleveland, and it is a very exciting venture, I think, for those of us in this profession, because we really would like it to succeed. If it succeeds, it then sets up other places that will charge for content. And that means that you change the paradigm of how the business is, and we can continue to have jobs heading forward. So Tim Kawakami is guest one. Our second guest is Matt Yaloff. He is a host and reporter at MLB Network. He will talk about the stroke he had last July and a pretty remarkable comeback for him to be on the air. Also, Matt is somebody who worked in both the Philadelphia and New York market, two crazy baseball crazy markets, and so he can give insight into that. And we will also give a shout out via Matt for the National Stroke Association, stroke.org. That's a website that is now near and dear to Matt Yaloff. So Tim Kawakami up first, then Matt Yaloff on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Okay, and as promised, we bring in Tim Kawakami, the editor-in-chief of The Athletic Bay Area. And that, if you're not familiar with The Athletic, you certainly will be after this conversation with Tim, but it is a subscription-based sports writing venture now in Chicago, Toronto, Cleveland, Detroit. Tim is heading up the Bay Area one. There is also a sort of a national athletic group in college football, headed up by Stu Mandel, college basketball, headed up by Seth Davis. And there will also be sort of a national feature one headed up by Paul Fichtenbaum. The last three people I mentioned are longtime Sports Illustrated colleagues, so I'm not going to lie. I have a stake in the game. I want them to do well. Tim Kawakami, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Hey, great to be with you, Richard. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Tim, you know, we have talked. I've known you for a while. We once shared the same arena in the sports media, and I always appreciated how you approached that beat, because I think we have very similar sensibilities.
I know we do.
I block far less people than you on Twitter, but that's okay. But this will be specific to The Athletic, because it's very, very interesting. I think most of you who listen to this podcast have heard of The Athletic. But if you haven't, I will let Tim sort of give you a little bit of a Cliff Notes version of what this is and what the focus is for these subscription sports writing sites around the country.
Yeah, I think really when you boil it down, it's the sports page pulled out of the newspaper, more importantly, pulled out of the newspaper economy, which we all know is faltering and really headed for kind of a, you know, finite end. And that's what was dawning on me, that maybe not every newspaper in the world is having major troubles heading towards the cliff, but mine was, and I think most of them are, and the economics just don't work. Sports writing, though, I believe there's a demand. I know there's a demand. There was demand in my old paper. It's just we could not figure out how the economics were going to work. The advertising in the main paper, the advertising digitally, the pop-up ads, these are things that just weren't going anywhere. Might end up somewhere, you know, 5 years, 8 years, I don't know. I don't know if the newspaper is going to last long enough to get to that spot. That bridge to this tomorrow that we never see. The Athletic is the idea of my co-founders, Adam Hansman and Alex Mather, had it 2 or 3 years ago. Let's just pull that out. We know there's a demand, and locally specifically, for coverage of the team, the 49ers, the Raiders, the Giants, the A's, the Warriors. I think for sure we could say there is a demand for good coverage, reporting, analysis, columns, Q&As, all these things. Let's just pull it out. It's an a la carte model. It's the cable industry is going through right now. People want to see sports. Well, they're pulling it out of cable and, you know, trying to see how that lines up that way, or HBO or whatever. This, to me, as I think it through, is basically HBO. Instead of having to get the whole cable system, you're just paying for maybe what you really want, what you need to read, what you need to see. In our case, it's sports writing. It's the best sports writing. It's with a startup culture, which, again, it strikes a lot of people as the right moment for this. We're not going to be burdened with having to cover this game or that team because it's what you've done for 20 years, what you've done for 50 years, what you've done for 80 years. We're going to cover what people want to read. Now, we're going to also go out and cover things that they decide they want to read after they see it. Maybe it surprises them. But the main thrust is going to be the main teams, the main personalities, what's important now, what will be important tomorrow, and you didn't know. And we're pulling it out of all the other things that have burdened the newspaper industry and a lot of other economic models for years. Come into a wall. They're running into something there. We're going to extend past that. We're going to be the direct model. You're paying it straight up for the subscription. The economic model is as clear as a bell. You subscribe to it, you pay for this journalism. We're not worried about having to get ads and what do the ads generate and trying to call up whoever called car dealers and all these things. No, it's a straight, direct line. Can't be any clearer. If we're good enough, people will want to read what we do. I hope we're good enough. The people I've selected, I believe we're already generating. We're 2 days into it, day and a half into it. Seem to be doing quite well with the readers and subscribers. I think if we deliver on what we promise, and with the promise of sports writing is we write about the stuff you want to read, we analyze it, we were fair, we ask the right questions, there will be a demand, and we're saying it just click the thing and you're subscribing, you'll get it straight. To me, it's the most direct thing I've ever heard in my life. I bought it 100%, and I hope everyone else joins along.
All right, Tim, listen, there's a lot there, and I appreciate you sort of giving people both the sales pitch as well as the background. This to me is where the rubber hits the road, and this is not, you know, if any of us could have figured this out, we'd all be millionaire or billionaires. The industry of journalism, whether it's news or sports or whatever, has given away its content for multiple generations now. Newspapers would have, even those with a paid or some kind of tier model, you might still get 10 free articles before you have to pay for that. Sports Illustrated obviously has a website, SI.com, that is free, and you can get content. So this is my sort of my preamble to the question, Tim, is how do you change the behaviors of readers and viewers and listeners who have grown up, mostly speaking a lot of times of younger people, but have grown up not paying for content? Because that to me is the key. How do you get them to buy into this is a product worth giving up your money for something that in your life, generally speaking, you have never given up money for?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's the question. I don't know that that's been entirely solved, but I'll say two ways. Practically, we're a startup. People are used to, and I'll put it another way, they've never, ever gotten what we're giving them free from The Athletic. I'm just saying it really practically. With our hand-chosen writers, our product, you know, with this beautiful app they got, they've never had it. It's a startup mentality. I think of it like Spotify or iTunes or any of the other subscription things that people in their 20s have you know, basically known all their adult lives. I think that habit is easier to form from the start than it is from, let's say, a newspaper that has, you're right, has been giving it away and is used to having it. Look, we want as many readers as possible, so we're just going to let you have it for free. We're not ever doing that. I think generally, I go back to the Spotify model. I think there is an understanding, not certainly not from everybody, and I wouldn't even say from the majority of people, but I think of people who are of age to pay for this, that paying for quality is not against any principle. You get used to it. It's another click on the mouse. I compared them. You know, once I start going on Amazon.com and I want a blanket or I want, you know, a shirt or I want whatever, it's just another click. Now, it's money. I'm not trying to lessen that. But I think in the culture we're in now, if you are something that people want, and we'll have to prove that, and we'll have to prove that every day, I don't think that hurdle is as big as it used to be. And I had it myself. I have had it myself when I'm reading papers and I get up, so I get to the paywall and I have to make the decision. I think it's becoming less and less of an issue, and it's a lot easier to do when you're a new thing. And I'm finding this even hiring writers. There are some people that just wouldn't write for a newspaper. It's the newspaper. It's whatever. It's the institutional thing. There's a lot of power in that, but there's also a lot of stodginess in that. There's a lot of old line thinking in that. If you just say, hey, this is a new thing. This is not the old thing. It's a new thing. I'm finding writers who are attracted to that, and I think that kind of ripples throughout readers. This is new. This is something that you've never gotten before. Again, doesn't mean it's better. I hope it's better, but it's something that just we're starting fresh without everything else. It just seems to me, it appeals to me as a writer. I think I would hope and I would think it's going to appeal just as something you never had this before. So now we're asking you to pay for it. I don't think that's as big a jump as maybe even 2 months ago, certainly more than 2 years ago.
Tim, what is the first year goal for subs?
I don't know that we're supposed to say so. I'll just say it's aggressive. San Francisco, it's a very aggressive situation. I think you probably know that Toronto is their most successful market to date.
Yep.
I think we're on the Toronto schedule. I'll put it that way.
Okay.
I'm not the boss. I'm not going to start throwing out numbers, but I think if you said our goals are to mirror as closely as we can what Toronto has done, I think it'd be a safe assumption. And I certainly want to do that. They've invested a lot of money in this operation. Hey, they're based in San Francisco. I go to their office. This is not the situation that the other cities have. It's something that's great for us. I think we can be a leading city. I sure hope to be. But I don't think I'm at liberty to talk about numbers. They've thrown out some numbers to me. I generally know what they are, but I kind of want to keep my mind off of that and just kind of do the best we can. And if we're not getting in there, I think I'll hear about it.
I understand. James Myrtle's been a guest on this podcast. The number he was throwing around was 10,000 subscriptions. I'm not asking you to comment on that. But
well, James is the Toronto editor-in-chief, and he's not usually wrong.
Yeah, right. All right, so here's the question, and this is interesting. And obviously every market is different. And some markets, goals will be higher or lower. Some markets, the competition is this and that. Have your two founders given you some kind of idea as to how long they're committed? Let's forget about the numbers for a second, but have they told you that, Tim, we are committed, let's say, to 2 years, we're going for it no matter what, we're going for it, you know, we're giving you 1 year, we're giving you 5 years. Has there been any talk about you're going to get this kind of runway to at least make the attempt to make it work?
No, I think that might have been more important for the earlier cities, but now where there was more questions just generally about the idea, just generally about was there an audience there? You hoped there was one, but you didn't really practically know. I think for us, I'm just looking at what Toronto's doing, I'm looking at what Chicago's doing, I'm looking at what Detroit's doing. It's in front of me, and they're not going anywhere. You never say never about anything, but this company's not going anywhere. The cities are growing, and I think what they found, and I think they can feel it, is with every new operation they open, it helps all the other ones because you get the other cities if you subscribe to one of them. I would hope we're helping Toronto, and I believe Toronto's helping us. Chicago, Detroit, Cleveland, the same. So there's been no talk of long-term because I don't think there needs to be. It's like with any, you know, beginning situation where you're not at the very beginning, but things are really feel a momentum. I don't think you say, hey, well, I need to know this thing's going to be going for another 3 years. I have every confidence that we'll be. I have every confidence that we're going to be part of that and we're going to be strengthened to that. So I didn't need to hear that because I know how well this company has thought out. And I know how well the other cities are doing.
Tim, in terms of publicity, I don't know if the right question is to ask you to sort of measure on sort of levels of importance, but does The Athletic, or at least The Athletic in the Bay Area, do you have to break news or can you, or would just quality reporting, quality opinion making, quality content be enough to draw? Like, I'm interested in, certainly in your market, but I guess the question could be for any market. Like, is it important for you guys to be some kind of news breaking outlet. Not necessarily Adam Schefter or Woj every day, but occasionally getting a story so you can get the name out there that these were the guys who broke the story.
Yeah, to me, I mean, I'll just put it this way. To me, it's not been uttered to me this way, but if you hire me and hire Marcus Thompson, my colleague, Bay Area News Group, who's now alongside me at The Athletic, I think you know what you're getting. We want to be on top of the news. We're not racing to get every single scoop, as you mentioned, but Marcus was with Steph Curry yesterday at the golf tournament, and Steph gave him three or four nationally important quotes. The LeBron thing obviously is getting a lot of run. That was to Marcus Thompson at The Athletic. He'll be credited that way. Now, I think that's just part. I think people assume Marcus is going to have those scoops because that's who he is. I think they assume I'm going to have interesting and potentially news-breaking information because that's who I am. It was not uttered that way to us when we were talking to The Athletic guys, Adam and Alex. But I think it's just assumed. If you are hiring me, I am going to be around the 49ers beat scoops and the Warriors scoops, and I will have some. That's who I am. If I don't, I'll be disappointed in myself. Now, whether it's important to have The Athletic in these, you know, I'm not really thinking of that way. I'm thinking for people to feel like they're on top of the 49ers story and on top of the Warriors story and on top of the Raiders story, those are going to be our three biggest, to tell you this right off the bat. They're going to want to read what we're writing, and they're going to want to be the first ones to read it. They don't want to wait for someone else to scoop it up and put it on an aggregated site. That's how I feel.
Okay.
And again, no one ever said that to me, but I think I just assume if you know the way I've written about the Warriors and the 49ers specifically, that, or you know that I talked to Mark Davis, a Raiders owner, more than most, and you know Marcus's relationship with Stephen Curry and with Steve Kerr and with Bob Myers and with Draymond Green. That's what you get with us, and we're not turning that off. Now, we have not said that scoops are the most important thing. We want to be the analysis site. We want to be deep. But Marcus and I, we are who we are, and I think that's why Marcus's piece today or yesterday with Steph Curry, I think, was very important for us to establish that right off the bat. You want the best stuff from Steph Curry. You want to understand what he's thinking. You're going to subscribe to that. I hate to make this sound like a spiel the whole time, but I do believe this, and it did happen yesterday. I think it was funny. The site wasn't even up yet about a week and a half ago, and I just reported on Twitter that Tom Gamble, the old 49ers executive, was joining up Jim Harbaugh's staff. I happen to know these guys pretty well. I know football pretty well, and that got picked up, certainly in Detroit papers, and the first one I got is Tim Kawakami of The Athletic is reporting. So, and I really wasn't even at The Athletic at the time. So that was kind of cool for me. And I just think if you know how this started and you know it starts with me and Marcus, I think that's why you hire us. And it was not said that way. It was not saying you must break this. I just think if you want to be around these teams, if you want to get a feel for this team, you go out and hire people like me and Marcus. And that's what they did.
We'll mention the co-founders are Adam Hansman and Alex Mather. Just in turn, when Tim mentions Alex and Adam, those are the co-founders of the of all The Athletic sites. Tim, what have these initial first couple of days been like in terms of have you gotten any kind of findings that you can use heading forward in terms of what initially works, maybe what initially doesn't work, the kind of subscriber you're already getting? What have these first couple of days told you, if they've told you anything?
You know, I'm also covering the 49ers, so I've been kind of in a blur here, producing content while also overseeing a lot of this. I know we feel very good about the numbers. I know we feel very good about when Marcus writes and when I write, and that's been important from the get-go. We are going to continue writing a lot. And then I think the other stories, we've had some great stories the first 2 days, and I really liked the first day, and we got a good reception, but I was even loving it because I thought the second day was going to be even better. And just the story package, a Rob Arthur story on the Giants, should they tank them, you know, 538 writer, with various other stories. I don't want to name them all, but that they're just a real solid collection. It's the totality of it is what I like. We're going to get you on all sort of different places. The media column we had that posted like an hour ago while I was at 49er camp. So that was, I assigned it. I hired the guy who writes Steve Berman, who wrote it, very good call, but I was reporting Eric Campbell as posted, so I was kind of – I missed the reaction to that one. I just think it's going to be the stories that you don't see in the newspaper anymore that people are going to react to, and not just one of them, hopefully two or three or four of them. I think generally, again, they've hired me and Marcus. The reaction has been strongest to the stories that Marcus and I write, and I that's the practical reality. That's what we expected, and the other stories are going to be very important for us also, but right now it's me and Marcus, and we're going to be writing a lot.
Tim, from what you understand, how will it work in terms of whatever when the Athletic National, for lack of a better word, has a feature story? How will it work, or how will it be implemented into, let's say, a local site like yours?
I don't think it's been fully scoped out, but my understanding, and I know Paul Fitzbaum very well, respect him a lot, is that, you know, if there's a story that has, you know, very specific local interest, we're going to be put it on our page, and it might just appear on our page because they'll know it's going to be interesting to our audience, you know, and if it's from a national writer, and if we write something that the national side really likes, they might be able to pull it and put it on their site. I think it's more of a shared content sort of situation. Again, I don't know that that's exactly how it's going to be. That's my understanding. I know we have some writers that are going to run nationally, or they're are very interested in hearing what they're going to do nationally. But I want them to, so they're going to write specific to our site also. But I think it's kind of a content, you know, spectrum where there could be five things on a national site, and we might really like one of them that's specific to San Francisco, or hits San Francisco, or reflects on San Francisco Bay Area, Oakland, San Jose, and we might just grab it and put it on our page. That's my general understanding. Doesn't mean that's absolutely the way it's going to happen, but that's my general understanding, and I sure would hope it works that way.
Tim, one of the interesting things for me is going to be how the Athletic is perceived by the teams, even to the point about credentialing. Can you give the audience a sense of, you know, this is it does have established people like you and Marcus, which is good, so you're known quantities at all the different teams, but it's still a new publication. So what have you – did you have to do any kind of outreach with all the major Bay Area teams, major Bay Area colleges to say, hey, this is who we are, we exist, and we are going to be applying for credentials at your places? I'm just wondering how that part of the process worked.
And I think this part especially was helped by the other sites, because I sent an email out to all the major PR directors just to let them know my involvement and that we will be covering them. And I can't say I know for sure, but it felt like maybe one or two or three teams kind of checked around. You know, like, okay, what's this site like? Let's talk to some other teams in Cleveland and Detroit and in Toronto and Chicago. I got that feeling. Now, they know me. They know what I represent. I don't think there was going to be a major question, but we have gotten positive reactions from every team that I've checked in with. And, you know, there might be one or two that still might have a question, but we are credentialed. We will be credentialed by everyone that we've checked with. I think if we were starting from scratch, it might be a different thing. And maybe some teams would say, good, this is our chance not to credential that Dan Caledon. I'm sure that might have gone through a few people's minds. But I think they realize the level that the other sites have gotten to. And I credit the other sites for a huge part of this. Established that this was a real thing and a growing thing. And teams recognize that. And they, Jed York, 49ers owner, who I have not gotten along really well, if anyone knows my work over the last several years, particularly since the end of the Harbaugh era. But the 49ers are, you know, I'm standing in Silicon Valley right now in Santa Clara. 49ers get the whole startup thing. They understand maybe that journalism needed a new avenue. And Jed York shook my hand, said he wished me luck, congratulated me for the new venture, and said he'll be watching. I think teams, and again, whether this is a threshold moment, I don't know. I might have said that, and now I'm thinking, you know, there's a lot of threshold moments. We don't know. It could be a threshold moment, then turn around and be an unthreshold moment in 2 days. I don't know. But I do think teams that are paying attention get that they're seeing new kinds of sites pop up, blogs and, you know, podcasts and all the things that we know about, and they know this is kind of formulating now, and you don't really know what the outlines of it are going to be. You don't know how this is going to be in a year, and they are interested in who's popping up where, where's the credibility. And another reason why you start by hiring me and Marcus is, you're informing the teams. This is the level of credibility we're going to be at and we're going to stay at. And so far I've had no questions other than, okay, you're going to cover us? Who are you going to have covering us? That's been the general conversation, and it's been all fair. I've told them I will answer any questions. I've told them I understand if you do have questions. So far, it's all been pretty smooth, and I am grateful for that.
Tim, one of the questions when I put out that you were going to be a guest on the podcast, sort of this question came in numerous different forms, and that is, how will you and your staff adapt in terms of promoting the stuff that's on your site as the paywall hardens? It, you're going to end up promoting, obviously, via Twitter, via Facebook, via social media. But, again, it's sort of like one of the questions I asked you earlier. People will be able to read part of the story, and then to get the rest of the story, you gotta pay. So have you thought about, it's interesting, they don't teach marketing and PR per se in journalism school, but this is a big part of not only all our jobs, but really, really your job these days.
Yeah, I'm learning on the fly, and I will go with Alex and Adam on a lot of this, obviously on all of it. Their experiences, you put one or two, three things up a day, a week, we'll see how the mix goes. We put Marcus's Steph Curry piece up free last night and exploded that way. I think it would have been just fine if we put it behind the paywall, but you also want people to test it out. This is early. See what we're going to give you. I don't think anyone has felt that, hey, I bought a subscription, and why are you putting this up free? And no one has said that. And we will be limited in that. But, maybe some of the bigger stuff we will unlock, basically make for free, at least for some period. I get why you do that. I understand you want people to get a feel and a flavor of what we're doing. And then the third time they look, they go, okay, I better buy this. It's something that I'm learning on the fly. I'm committed to this. I'm like a new convert, so I'm the most zealous. I'm like, put everything behind a paywall. Come on, we got to make them pay for this. But I understand the process, and I do want people to see what we're doing. I don't want them to turn away. So there will be some free, maybe even today. I've been at 49ers, so I haven't really been minding the site today. But I do believe that you want people to feel welcome, but also that they're on the path towards buying that subscription, and we do want them to buy the subscription. But I don't know that we have to do too much of that. And again, I'm the zealot. I just think I'm now of the point that if you want our stuff, you should be willing to pay for it. And it isn't that much. I wouldn't have said that, Richard, honestly, 3 months ago. I'm saying it now, and I do believe it. I don't think I'm turning around on that one, but I get how you have to program this, and I get that there are levels to this that I certainly haven't learned, so that's how we're doing it. Maybe one free a day, maybe one every other day. Haven't quite figured out that formula, but it's going to be, the promotion's going to be that way, and then when you get enough of it, I think, hopefully you're convinced that, yes, it's worth 20 cents, 25 cents a day. Hopefully that's the step people take.
Tim, what is the cost per month and then per year?
It's $6 a month, I believe. It's, I should know this because, but we've had discount deals. I believe it's $40 a year right now, but that will go up because this is the discount period right now. But I think general $6 a month is the general fee. You can get it for cheaper over the year, but I think right now it's $40 a year.
All right, a couple more here. In terms of the logistics, how do writers file? Do they file into a desk the way you think of traditional sports journalism, or do they all have access to whatever the CMS is and they can file these stories direct onto the site themselves?
I think pretty soon we're going to have most of our regulars hooked up to the system, and they dump it in, and then we'll be able to see it there. And several of them, we've used a couple people who have filed to other cities, regulars in other cities, so they have the access to it, and it's a lot easier when they do. Most of my contributors, however, are emailing to me, and I'm copying and pasting and putting in the system, which does put a lot of responsibility on my back. I can't go run away for 3 hours and just forget about it. So it's both ways. I think we're going to set it up where most of them will have access to the system where they can just, you know, pop it in. And that's one good thing that newspapers going to the WordPress blog system, bloggy style system the last few years, certainly the Mercury News is one of them. That's our system. So I am very comfortable with much of it. Now, my co-founder will mention that I'm probably not familiar with as much of it as I could. As we put these sections out, but we're learning, we're going with it. Marcus is a lot better at it than I am, I hate to say. But I am learning. I'm an old newspaper fogey learning some of these coding things. And it's both mostly at this point people emailing to me and me putting it up and us taking a look at the day.
All right, a couple more here. You know, in terms of in a very inside baseball circle, you are known on Twitter as someone who is very quick with the block button, sort of the Dikembe Mutombo, if you will, of blocking. The irony now, of course, Tim, is that in theory, everybody is a potential Athletic subscriber, and want to block potential customers? This is a very interesting like position you now find yourself in. Yeah. In that, you know, you never know. Maybe somebody might disagree with one of your opinions, but they, in theory, could be somebody interested in the larger overall contact of the Athletic. Will that affect how you roll on Twitter?
It will not affect whether I decide to block someone. That is the easiest decision in the world. If someone is rude to me or decides to spew some racial epithets or just annoys me, I'm blocking them. And I made that decision a long time ago. It's like there's certain people I just don't need to read me. Now, when we talk about the site, when we talk about subscriptions, we are developing a conversation where we might have an amnesty program tied to subscriptions. Now, that doesn't mean if I unblock somebody over this, and I want to be clear, I might do this. We're still talking about it. I still can block them. You know, if you're rude to me again, this is not changing. I'm not changing the way I approach this. This is not going to be a salesmanship thing. I get tired of somebody. I have blocked people that I shouldn't have. If you're looking at my career goals, I've done that before. I will do that in the future. Twitter's a whole other animal for me. I think it's livelier that way. It's just the way my mind works. But we are discussing, and I have certainly raised it myself, that it is possible. And I've run into people who are very normal people who just said a couple things to me, and I blocked them that I don't mind. Unblocking. I just have a policy where I don't really do that. But I might get to. Oh, there's Peter King walking by. Oh, my goodness. Peter, thank you. Appreciate it. I'm on Deitch's podcast right now.
No, love that.
That was good.
Nice. Appreciate that. Should have put Peter on. Okay. I could have done a quick spot.
I can't be your producer here, Richard. but no, it's a discussion. And again, I really don't want to. My emphasis is I don't want to change my behavior on Twitter just because of this. But this one time, like Marcus and I on our basketball Warriors Plus Minus podcast, Marcus started a Twitter amnesty program where people appealed to him to get me to unblock them, and he just got overwhelmed. He's got too many of them. That is the weird result of all this. Certainly was not planned. I didn't get into the blocking thing in order to set this up. I swear that it just was a natural thing, but it got to be too many people. If these people are rational people, and many of them are, or most, and we figure out how to do this, I think we're going to have at least one wave of this, and we will have many people unblocked. Now, I don't know when that's going to happen, but we are moving in that direction. We're going to get out of all this chaos of the first few days. But as we get later to August, I think we're going to do that.
All right, a couple more here. In terms of content, Tim, is this will content exist? New content exist 7 days a week, or is this more of a five-day a week proposition? Or what is it exactly?
Yeah, we're going to go seven. That doesn't mean we're going to go crazy on the weekends. We'll take a look at the readership numbers on the weekends. But I definitely, my schedule has things on the weekends. I have plotted people on the weekends right now. Lisa Olson is going to write a Sunday column. Old style newspaper, isn't that, Richard?
Oh, wow.
Sunday column.
I love that.
Writing a Sunday column.
It's great.
But I like her on a Sunday. I like, you know, she's an essayist. She's a wordsmith. She thinks big thoughts. When I think of Lisa, when I knew I wanted Lisa on board, I wanted her to write. Don't feel like you're tied to any. Write something big. So for the time, you know, right now we're going to have a Sunday columns. We're going to have some notes columns tied to Friday and Saturday, and maybe Marcus writes a notes column on Sunday. So we'll start. I mean, I've been advised that we don't have to go too heavy on the weekend, but we'll start with it. We got so many stories that I don't want to put 9 stories on a Thursday when I could sprinkle 1 or 2 of them on a Saturday and Sunday. So we'll be 7 days a week. Maybe Sunday is going to feel more like a Sunday paper expansive thing. I still have that gene in me. Maybe it'll get cooked out of me eventually, but right now I still want Sunday to kind of be more like, hey, look, I got some extra time. Let me read something substantial. And I believe Lisa's going to be that, and I believe we're going to have other things. And then if the readership doesn't really set up for that, then we'll move it around. But right now we are 7 days a week.
I love that. So Lisa Olson writing a Sunday column for you. That's fantastic.
Yep.
Is she?
Yeah, I really like that. It just seems right to me.
Yeah. Is she based in the Bay Area? I did not even know that. That's great.
Yeah, that's the part that she might not be in the Bay Area for much longer. Again, I don't want to go too much into it, but for as long as she is, yeah, she's in the Bay Area. I said, I want you writing for us. That's what I want. And she has agreed to it, at least temporarily. And she's my Sunday columnist until she tells me she's not.
I love it. News being broken here. All right, here's the sort of the last area I want to get into. It's interesting to me. And you're not this doesn't pertain to you so much as it pertains to some other people who have been hired by The Athletic, and specifically my old colleague Seth Davis. And what's interesting here is that one of the things I really appreciate about Sports Illustrated, and maybe your place, your old place, was like this too, Tim, is that they have never, ever put any kind of restrictions on us in terms of what we are tweeting about on our Twitter feeds. You could also make the argument that, and I think a legal one, that my Twitter feed is not owned by Sports Illustrated. It's owned by me.
Yep.
I may benefit from the publicity that Sports Illustrated gives me, but it is my feed. Getting back to Seth Davis, of course, Seth is very, very political on Twitter. His father's Lanny Davis, longtime Clinton counsel, et cetera. Have you, Tim, thought about how you want your staff to interact on social media regarding topics away from social media? I realize that's getting a little deeper into an organization that is very, very new, but it just strikes me as a startup that all this stuff's going to come into play. And, you know, it's a little easier for me to talk about politics on Twitter because SI is much more established in The Athletic. My content's free, et cetera, et cetera. When you guys do it, you know, it strikes me that there's like much more of a real risk because you're asking people to pay for stuff. So I wonder if this kind of stuff has even entered your ecosystem, and if so, what are your top-line thoughts?
Yeah, this certainly would come from my co-founders way more than it would come from me, but it's an interesting point. I've thought about it a little bit. I think first I'd say I'm not going to want writers writing for me if I'm bothered by anything that they've done, and I'm not saying politically. I'm just saying that, you know, Twitter, blog, anything. It's such a self-selected thing right now that, you know, there might be 1 or 2. I'm not going to say for sure, but that not just on Twitter, but on any other platform, I haven't been real thrilled with, and I haven't brought them on board. So, but also these are freelancers. Marcus is hired full time. We are announcing another one today, but I don't think he's announced yet, so I'll let him do it. And you know, we're the full timers. So I think if there are any place where I could take a harder look at that, that would be just with the full-timers. If you're a freelancer, I'm not going to try to influence what you say or don't say on Twitter. You could say I'm someone that someone should try to calm down, and I'm not calming down. So I haven't really – I don't think there's a policy. I don't think there needs to be. I think we all know when somebody might be going over the line just generally, and I wouldn't – you know, again, I wouldn't say anything politically. I'd just say the tone or the attitude – or the, you know, the way you treat people, but otherwise, no. And if there was anything, it would come from the founders, and I certainly have heard nothing from them on this. And I don't know, I can't imagine that there would be, just other than behave like a journalist behaves. That might mean you're opinionated. That might mean you're getting some people mad, but that's all right. As long as you behave like a journalist behaves, I'm okay with everything else from there.
Here's my last one, Tim, and it's a subject, obviously, that you've talked about. It feels like forever, even though it's probably only been a couple of years, and that's Colin Kaepernick. Could you give me your thoughts on how you feel that story has been covered away from San Francisco. Me and you could probably do a podcast on all the opportunists who have rolled on Kaepernick content. But you're you're very much I don't even want to say a Kaepernick supporter. I think you are just not, you do not buy into a lot of the nonsense that gets thrown out about him. But from your perch in the Bay Area, as someone who has interviewed Colin Kaepernick more than 99.9% of the press, how have you seen this story play out nationally?
I mean, I think he's become a national pinata / talking point for everybody on the extreme. It happens. It's become something that's been oversimplified, overdramatized, exaggerated. But I will also, having been there at the beginning of this and asking him some of the more pointed questions about this, and this will surprise people. People are getting mad at me on the Kaepernick side at the beginning because I was trying to figure it out. I was trying to just have him explain what was going through his mind in this. I just wanted to know. And they saw it as questioning the ideals, and I wasn't doing that. Colin, at the time, knew what he was getting into. He knew this was symbolic. He knew this might, he said it himself, this might end his career. He even said this might end his life. He said these things. Now, he had every reason to say those things and still want to work. And my opinion, which I've written many times, is he deserves work because he's one of the top 30, 35 quarterbacks in the NFL and has broken no laws and has disrupted no locker room. But beside the point, this has become just a national, talk show fest where things get pulled way out of proportion, where people's opinions, they decide what they're going to think and then warp every other fact to try to get into it. And if they have to lie, they lie. And that's what I call people out on. But I do, one thing I have respected about Kaepernick from the beginning is he knew this was going to happen like this. Maybe not to this extent, but he knew that this was going to create this discussion, and this discussion could go to very strange places. Again, that doesn't mean he has to be happy with where this discussion has gone. Doesn't mean he has to be happy that he's not a quarterback in this league, and now the owner of the Ravens is reportedly the one who's saying he's not going to come here. And maybe the coach and general manager would like to see that. But he saw this. This was part of what his protest was about, that if he can't say it and maintain a job in the NFL, that just underlines his point. It's a social activism point. You don't have to agree with the point, but by him saying, I could lose my job and I'm still doing this, it's got my respect. Whatever it is, that's got my respect. If you're breaking no laws, if you're hurting no one else, if you're just making a stance, and, I happen to say the stance that is trying to give voice to the people who don't have voices, it's hard for me to say, geez, what a terrible person. Not a terrible person. I've dealt with him. He and I have gone back and forth back when he wasn't really good with the media. But of course, last year he was unbelievable. He wanted to answer all questions. But when he was leading the 49ers to that Super Bowl, he wasn't very good to deal with. But I still understood who he was. And the one thing I would say to people who maybe don't know him and don't understand where this came from, this is someone it was kind of going through a discovery. Discovery himself, an adopted child, and kind of was seeing things open up. And you could see it that summer, last summer was, kind of dawning on him. And even the year before, things kind of were dawning on him. And it to me, it felt like someone going to college. And he's older than this, but someone going to college and seeing new things and talking to new people. And his mind was going to different places. And he was excited about a lot of it, and he was sickened by a lot of it. And some of the things he did were like a kid in a college symposium wearing the pig socks. Unfortunately, he has not done that since. Wearing the T-shirt of Fidel Castro, he has not done that since. It just was somebody exploring new levels and feeling, more about himself, understanding more about himself as he did it, and taking stands that he knew were unpopular, and that's part of doing it, is the unpopularity shows that the stance is important because people want to fight you on stuff that is too sensitive for them to really understand or believe in. All these things, to me, felt like a college symposium, and I like that. I like guys who try to think, get to these spots, and that was what Kaepernick was going to. Now, it might be a little different now with all these hardened positions and all that he's heard and all that he said. But back then, a year ago, it was about someone finding out about himself and finding out about the world and finding out about new ideas, and I'm never going to be against that.
Tim Kawakami is the editor-in-chief of The Athletic Bay Area. The Athletic, as we have noted many times here, new subscription site in multiple cities across this country. Tim is in charge of the one in the Bay Area. He's got Marcus Thompson, who has been a guest on this podcast and who everybody who follows me on Twitter or listens to this podcast knows I'm a huge fan of as well. So two guys at the center of that new project that if you're a Warriors fan or a Raiders fan or a Niners fan are absolutely must reading. Tim, I wish you honestly the best of luck with this. I do think, like you, that stuff like this has to succeed in order for all of us to be able to get legit jobs where, you know, we can live in a community and pay for our apartments or houses. So selfishly, I'm certainly rooting for this to do well. And I'm sure I will be talking to you over the internet, as the kids say. So I wish you the best of luck with this. And I'll be checking in with you in a couple of months, maybe again on a podcast to see how things are going.
That sounds good, Richard. I really appreciate it. And I'm glad I could bring Peter on for a little bit there.
It's nice.
It's about as good as I could do. Someone walking by.
A very expensive cameo. Trust me on that one. Thank you very much, Tim Kawakami, for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
You got it, Richard.
Okay, my thanks to Tim Kawakami. And before we get to Matt Yaloff, let's talk about Barbasol. The biggest thing to happen in Barbasol since shaving cream is, well, the only thing to happen in Barbasol since shaving cream. Introducing new Barbasol razors. Barbasol, of course, is the brand America trusts for a close, comfortable shave, and now they have premium disposable razors. Barbasol's close shave technology on every razor means you get an advanced pivoting head and ultra-thin, open-flow blades. The Ultra 6 Plus razor features a seventh blade, specifically designed to refine and style tricky areas like under the nose, sideburns, and beard. I can attest that this is a good razor. Visit Barbasol.com and get a $2 savings coupon and see for yourself why Barbasol razors are the number one new disposable razors out there. You're looking good, America. You're shaving with Barbasol. Okay, thanks to Barbasol, as always, for sponsoring this fine podcast. And we now bring in Matt Yaloff, the fine host of the MLB Network. You most notably see him on Strike Zone, which airs on the Strike Zone channel, but obviously is part of MLB Network and its properties. Matt Yaloff, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Matt, we'll eventually get to what I really want to talk about, and that's what happened to you on July 29th, 2016. But before we get to that, you've had a long career in baseball broadcasting, so I think you're an interesting guy to ask this. What do you consider the hardest job in baseball broadcasting and why?
You know, that's a good one. I think that the greatest challenge that I have experienced in my years in doing this is when it comes to having access to a player or players for a very short amount of time, and the challenge is maximizing that time to get what you need or what the story happens to be. And that involves conserving words, conserving run-on questions, and it really there's somewhat of an art form to it in that you have the idea of what you want to talk about, but forming a intelligent question in a succinct manner that produces more than a three-word answer. And part of that, I think, is understanding the personality of the person you're talking to at that moment. Because just like everybody else, anybody walking this earth, players have their own personalities. And understanding that, you have to be a quick study. If it's a player that you have not dealt with often, you got to get a feel for that guy. because if you don't, the interview or the information that you're gathering could really fall short of what's necessary.
Matt, when you're doing a show like MLB Network Strike Zone, which basically, you know, MLB Network has access to every game, up-to-the-minute highlights, live look-ins, and what I imagine would be interesting about that show is obviously it can change any night, it can change every minute. So how do you, as detailed as you can, how do you go about preparing for that particular assignment? Is it a question of basically reading, researching, knowing everything you possibly can about baseball every day, or in some other manner do you research for your job?
Well, the first thing I would say is that without the research department at MLB Network, I think many people, I won't speak for them, but I know I'd be up the creek, because the amount of time and information, they're the heroes of that TV network, in my opinion. The volume of information, the depth of the information, and putting it together in a cohesive, easy-to-read type of packet is what gives you the substance to dig in. And whether it's analyzing a game or talking about a game or predicting what might happen based on numbers, it's invaluable. And that is the bulk of my preparation, is becoming familiar with that research. The other part of it is the Strike Zone show is a different animal than many of the other programs on MLB Network in this way. You do not have an analyst to work with. You don't have questions to bounce off of a former player. What you have is a blank canvas and three consecutive nonstop hours of action. And on a given night, you know, if we go on the air 7 p.m. Eastern, you might have seven or eight games in that hour, then a few more starting in the 8 p.m. hour. So you may have 10, 12, 13 games going simultaneously. So the juggle for me is when do you drop the knowledge, statistical knowledge? When do you drop that on the viewer? When do you save it for a more relevant time in the game? How do you tell the story of the game? It's tough to jump right in and, you know, in the first inning, Bryce Harper doubles. You know, what am I going to say? I didn't play. No one's looking for me to tell them what he did on that swing. So it becomes a question of backing up what the viewer is seeing with something pertinent. But at the same time, there's always a but, right? At the same time, you don't want to sound like a windbag by pulling numbers up that really don't mean anything just because you have them. That's the juggle. That's the challenge. And I hope that answers your question. I think it does.
Matt, what in terms of the research packets, give listeners a sense of what are you getting on a given night? How detailed are the packages and what's in there?
Okay, well, take a night when there are 15 games. Every Tuesday, every Friday are examples of days in which everybody plays, barring a rainout. That's when Strike Zone is on the air. So what you have is a packet of information that consists of standings, the obvious stuff, leaderboards, maybe who's hot, who's not. But then for every game, there is a page, and it's single-spaced, and it goes from the top all the way down to the bottom. And it includes the most pertinent information about a team, about the series that they happen to be in, about individual players, about milestones, about things in which we call it in television advancing the story. Advancing the story is done in news, in financial news, in sports. It's all about getting ahead of something before it happens and talking about the ramifications of it. An easy example would be Yu Darvish is on the mound. Now, remember, the non-waiver trade deadline is coming up. This could be his last start in Texas. I'm going back to July, obviously. I'm giving you an example of what advancing the story means. It could mean a player who is on a cold streak. However, the guy he's facing today is the guy he has owned in his career. So multiply that times 15 for 15 games, and you're looking at the bulk of the research packet, and these guys put it out every single day. It's the information is it's fantastic, and I think I would say this as people access more and more numbers and information, you know, anything you want you can find somewhere online. So what the challenge that it gives them is they need to produce something that perhaps you didn't think of. You know, 20 years ago, you'd give the basics. And, you know, maybe not even everybody was aware that Jose Altuve had a 13-game hit streak. That's child's play compared to what's available now.
All right, Matt, can you, rather than me give the backstory here, can you tell listeners what happened to you on July 29th, 2016?
Yeah, and, you know, the story's been told a few times, but I'll give you the nuts and bolts of it. July 29th, 2016 was a day like any other day in my life. It certainly didn't end that way. I was home. I was off. It was a Friday. And The Rundown, the show I've been hosting for years, was not on that day because of, I believe, a day game was going to be on MLB Network. I out of nowhere, with no warning whatsoever, I went completely blind and paralyzed. I suffered an ischemic stroke while in my basement home alone. And what has followed has been, to call it life-changing doesn't do it justice. I'm lucky to be alive for sure. The journey has been something that you might read in a book or see in a movie. My wife found me. I have no recollection of it. In fact, I don't remember much of the next 3 to 4 days. I ended up in ICU for, I believe it was 8 days. I was transferred to a clinic as an inpatient, Burke Rehabilitation, based in White Plains, New York. And the reason I mention it is because the work they did with me has allowed me to return to, I won't call it a normal life, but I'll call it a life. I was there for about 4 weeks, and the process of getting better to the point of being released from that program, I had to relearn how to walk. I had to relearn how to talk. And I still battle some significant physical deficits. The right side of my body, from my knee to the top of my head, including my arm and my hand, are of limited use. And speaking with neurologists, it's not likely to change for the better. The amount of recovery that takes place in the first few months, 3 months, 4 months, it depends on who you ask, that's a good indicator of when and how you're going to resume your life. Sometimes we just passed the 1 year mark, and there are many, many days where I sit and I just stare and I think about what happened and how to move forward. That's it in a nutshell. I'm, you know, being here and breathing the air is quite a luxury, I would say.
All right. Obviously, a number of things come up from that story, Matt. First off, was there any kind of warning that this would happen? And did doctors tell you after the fact what caused the stroke or what they think might have caused it?
It's a great question. The answer to the warning is zero. I had zero reason to think I was sick. That is probably the scariest part. Is that there was nothing. And when you read about what stroke can do, everybody, I shouldn't say everybody, but when you learn about something that happens to you, you want to learn everything. And sometimes I chuckle. I look at the likelihood of having one. And people who do A, B, and C are more likely. These are people who should be on the lookout. And you're talking about things that just did not include me.
Wow.
None of the things on the list, none of them, literally none of them. And it's a lesson in understanding that this particular illness can strike anyone at any time. And I think of stroke, or I did prior to a year ago, I chalked it up as, oh, yeah, it happens to old people. It's just not the case. I saw many people younger than I am. I'm 48, 47 at the time of it. I saw people significantly younger. To answer the second part of your question, it took a very long time for them to pinpoint why. There are many people who never know why, but we have pinpointed that there is a condition in my heart that roughly 20% of people have, but way fewer than that ever know they have it. So you could be walking around with it as I was my entire life, but wouldn't know it until something went wrong. And in an effort not to get too medical, because that is definitely not my background, a clot made itself out of my heart and traveled to my brain. And that is the reason for what happened.
This calamity happens to you, and obviously, thank God you're alive, and your wife found you, and you clearly had really great doctors. But in the midst of all this, including the rehab, you have this job at the MLB Network, where, as you know, Matt, it's an incredibly competitive business. There are more people. The supply always outweighs the demand in terms of the people who want these jobs, as well as the people, quite frankly, who could perform these jobs. So how were you able to navigate keeping your MLB Network job? And kudos to them, obviously, because they were a big part of this. But how did you navigate keeping that job while having the ability and the time to rehab so that you could get back to working and walking around and taking care of your children, et cetera?
Yeah, you said it. Kudos to them. The way that we've been treated, my wife and I, through this whole process has been first rate every step of the way. They handled this in such a sensitive and thoughtful way that it's humbling. You know, you hear stories of people who, you know, as you suggested, can't keep a hold of their job or their livelihood. What they did for me was they took all of the pressure off. And they said on many occasions, get better, take care of yourself. And for 6 months after I was released from inpatient care, 6 months, every week, I was in therapy as an outpatient, 3, 4, 5 days a week, not to mention the work I did on my own when I was not technically in a class or in a session. They understood. The key here to me is that they understood just how long this could take. They obviously educated themselves enough to say, hey, wait a minute. He's not coming back here in 2 or 3 months. And I can't even put into words how thankful I am. That was by far the best place I'd ever worked. I've been around. That is the best place I ever worked before I got sick. Hmm. Now, my view of it is it can't even be described what these folks, starting with Rob McGlary, the president, and going down to Dave Patterson and Lorraine Fisher and Michael Santini and the folks in human resources, the paperwork, and I'm sorry to rattle on, the paperwork that my wife had to do was mind-numbing. And she got every bit of help that she needed from the folks in human resources.
A lot of times, Matt, it's cliche, but it seems like it's one of those things that it's cliche because there's truth to it. People have a different outlook on life after they go through a significant health scare and come out on the other side. Have you changed your approach either professionally? I imagine personally you certainly have, but how let me see if I can sort of ask this direct. How has the stroke changed how you approach your job in baseball broadcasting?
Huh. Well, I have to figure out where to start on that one. I'll give you a general answer, and then I'll get into what you actually asked me. It would be quicker for me to tell you how I'm the same than tell you how I'm different. Because what is different and how things are different is dramatic. Everything is different. The way I process information is different. The way I walk around is different. My view of the world is different. My view of family, job, money, status, family, every category has been affected. Some of it has been affected because of the experience. There are two different categories that I have discovered. The experience, and most people have had an experience where they say, holy, you know, holy whatever, I'm never going to do X, Y, Z again. I have a different appreciation. That's a personal thing, right? Everybody's different. That is, without question, has played a role. The other element or the other portion here is that in talking to my neurologist, you are different because part of your brain is dead. So in that scenario, your brain rewires itself, and there are new pathways. And the way neurologically that you operate, factually, it is different. So those are two ways to describe the differences. Broadcasting-wise, I was, and anybody I ever worked with would be able to tell you, I say was, I stress the past tense. I wasn't type A. I was type A plus. I was addicted to work. I was addicted in attempting to be perfect. I was not. I'm not suggesting I was. It was an obsession. It was a daily exhausting process of, is this worded correctly? Should I play with these words differently? Should I ask my question in 10 words or 12 words? It was probably unhealthy, the way in which I viewed my job. And I will tell you that I did not enjoy it nearly the way I should have. I enjoyed it, but there was always a yeah, but with me. It was always, yeah, I'm going to the World Series and I'm going to be assigned the Giants, but, well, what's the but? The but should be, this is awesome. But for me, the but was, I got to get this guy because last night he had two home runs, and if I don't get that interview, then blah, 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 blah. Well, that's gone. I'm happy to say that's gone. And going to work for me now and talking about baseball for a living is a it's an experience to be cherished and something to hold on to and to look forward to every day when I get in that car to go in.
Matt, I realize the segue of this question a little bit is about essentially what is a different life based on the answer you just gave, but you have worked in two red-hot baseball markets, Philadelphia and New York, for an extended period of time. Can you give people who are listening to this podcast who are not from the East Coast or not really familiar with New York and Philadelphia what baseball is like in those cities?
Sure. I grew up in New York, so I have the background with the Mets and the Yankees. I grew up a diehard Mets fan. Let me do it this way. In New York, I'm going to talk Mets here because that, to me, that's kind of where I always was, and then I worked for them. In New York, it is life. Baseball is life. It is, even though there's the Giants and the Jets, I still believe it's a baseball city. And you feel pain when the team stinks. You celebrate when the team is good. You know where you were when Jesse Orosco threw his mitt up in the air. You know where you were when the Cardinals broke your heart in 1985. It's a daily soap opera that you feel a part of. I tweeted something about going to Shea in the 1980s included an insane parking lot, and what I included was the name of the guy who scalped us tickets. His name was Pete, and I knew the parking area that he would be in every day. And it brought back memories. That, to me, and as a Mets fan, I should add, you're always prepared for the worst because that's what you've grown up doing. That's the best way I can explain it. Philadelphia, in my experience, and I do need to couch it by saying when I was in Philadelphia, they were not good. It was before their run in 2007, 8, 9, 10. I was not in Philadelphia at that point. When I was there, they were quite bad. And the overwhelming feeling that I experienced from the fans who are from there and live there was that they couldn't wait to bash their team. They were looking for an excuse to say, see, I told you we sucked. Now, again, that's not everyone, but that's the feeling that I felt. Now, when they got good a few years after I left, I can't speak to that because I wasn't living there at that time.
All right, let's finish up with a couple questions that people had for you. These are more baseball-centric. And got a number of questions on the Astros, Matt, in terms of obviously as a regular season play, they're incredibly legit. Just look at their record and their team. But the question is, did they do enough at the, in your opinion, at the trade deadline to set themselves up for a long postseason run, particularly after the Dodgers acquired Yu Darvish and some of these other teams acquired some pitchers? Well, maybe nobody else acquired a pitcher at Darvish's level, but did they do enough at the trade deadline, in your opinion, specifically that in the sense that they could have really used an ace, the way maybe the Yankees got a Sonny Gray and the Dodgers got a Yu Darvish?
The answer from me is no, they did not. It's a great team. I'm not taking that away from them. But we've seen now over and over and over and over that swing and miss starters and bullpen pieces, when you miss bats, you have postseason success. I don't believe their rotation is going to be deep enough. I think that Dallas Keuchel, when healthy, fantastic. McCullers, right now, not healthy. After that, you know, I'm not seeing a bunch of guys that can overwhelm you in the postseason. You're going to be facing the best of the best if you get to the second round. I don't think they did. Now, they may be a rare exception in that they can out-hit you. It's an amazingly wonderful offense. It's dynamic. It's got everything. It's got the guys who are the co-stars. It's got the guys who get the headlines. It's got guys who make contact. Very key. Got to have contact. If you're not a contact hitting team, I think there's trouble awaiting you. And we have seen many times that the team that dominates in the regular season is not the right formula to win a short series. The Braves reminded us of that for years and years. I hope for the Astros' sake they do have enough. I certainly wouldn't call it a slam dunk.
Got a question about strike zone, and that right now it's on two nights a week. Has there ever been any talk about going five nights a week or some kind of more daily schedule?
You know, I'm not privy to that. That's not something I even know the answer of or answer to. The thinking behind Tuesdays and Fridays is that very often MLB Network is carrying or producing a game. And what Strike Zone allows you to do is, if let's call it, I don't know, the Dodgers and the Diamondbacks. If that doesn't interest me, and I'm an American League guy living in the East, why would I watch the Dodgers and the Diamondbacks as an example? Strike Zone gives you the opportunity to keep up on all the games because it's very similar in format to MLB Tonight, the multiple winner of Emmys that is the cornerstone of MLB Network. So it's an opportunity to sit back, and the show moves so fast. If you haven't watched it, very similar to Red Zone in the NFL. We're just from game to game to game. For big at-bats, for big situations, no hitters, rallies, whatever it may be, Strike Zone has the ability to get there in a three-hour block. Let's put it this way. If I wasn't working, I'd be at home watching it.
Hmm. Do you have, in the course of your last, how long you've been to major, how long you've been at MLB Network for, Matt? 10 years or so?
I got there in the year they started, 2009. I got there about 5 months into it. So let's see, let me count. 9, 10, 11, 12.
So basically eight years.
This is my ninth season.
Okay, ninth season. Over the course of either, you can answer this two ways. Either over the course of your 9 years, or if you want to use the players currently today. Are there a couple people that you really enjoy talking to because maybe you can even see them heading into the profession after they're done playing?
That's an easy, easy answer for me because he just joined MLB Network a few months ago. There is no one like Jim Thome.
Yeah.
Jim Thome, when he arrived in Philadelphia, I'm going to guess because a lot of these years get jumbled in my new brain, if you will. When he arrived there, let's call it 2002 or 2003 or somewhere in there, we had a connection based on his honesty, his availability, and respect, the amount of respect that I gave him and I attempt to do with everybody I would talk to, was reciprocated. And that, I'm not bashing the Phillies here, but that was a very difficult time to cover the Phillies. That was a cast of characters who, let's just say, were not aligned with the mission statement of the media. When he came in, we made an immediate connection. He had his first child roughly the same time we had ours. And I had seen him through the years at different events or different games. And when I saw him in the hallway at MLB Network maybe a month ago, he gave me this bear hug. You know, that's a real guy. That is a stand-up guy and my all-time favorite.
And Matt, you have twins, correct? Boy, girl, 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 or boy, boy?
I have boy, girl, twins, and a daughter.
So the daughter's older than the twins? Am I correct about that?
Correct. She's 2 years older than they are.
How old are your twins now, if I can ask?
They just turned 13, which means that I will be out more money than I thought I was going to be out. Man, they're expensive. I'm kidding around. They're awesome. They are. My wife and I are blessed with three healthy, and man, I stress healthy, healthy, happy, fairly well-adjusted kids, and I don't know what else you could ask for.
Yeah, that's great. All right, and then finally, and again, understanding you work for MLB Network, you're invested in baseball, you love the sport, you believe in the game. When you look at the health of this sport long-term, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 years down the road. How healthy do you think baseball is with the larger paradigm of kids being interested in it today?
I think baseball is healthy from a standpoint that it's a sport and an interest and a hobby, whatever word you want to call it, that continues to be passed down through the generations. I grew up in a baseball house, so I can speak to that. When you're little, it's just automatic that you're going to like X team, depending upon the region of the country or where your parents may be from. It still gives you the ability to use baseball in a gathering type of way or in a get-together kind of way. It reminds even younger people, I do believe, it reminds them of hanging out with the family with the baseball game on. So in that regard, I think it's okay. I think it's good. I think the product is good enough to do that, if that makes any sense. Where you do find an issue, and I actually noticed this myself with my son, more has to happen in a shorter period of time. If you're watching a game, especially today, strikeouts and home runs are at an all-time high. Well, what does that mean? It means that there's less action on the field. There's less balls, fewer balls put in play, more balls that are not even fielded because they end up in the stands and the outfield. The time in which that takes is too long. And I didn't believe that I would be someone who thought change was necessary, because I'm kind of a purist in that way. I love thinking about and talking about the way baseball was in the 70s and 80s. But the truth is, that's gone. That is not the way it's played now. It's different. The rules are generally the same. The fields look a little bit different. But the way in which people my age grew up with it has changed. And they're going to need to figure out a way to make these games shorter, less time between plays, and a way to draw and keep young fans. That is the challenge, and it's going to be quite a challenge, and I think it's going to evolve over time.
Matt Yaloff is a host and a reporter for MLB Network. Also a longtime guy in baseball. You've seen him on Comcast if you've lived in Philly, SNY, if you live in New York. And most importantly, is healthy now after a stroke last year, which he told you about. And remarkable journey back, and obviously a pretty amazing family, specifically his wife, to help make that possible. Matt, we wish you nothing but the best of health heading forward. And we'll definitely be checking you out on the MLB Network for sure. Thank you so much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Well, I appreciate the time and the interest. And if I can just say, as I say goodbye to you, figure out what is important and what is not, because it required a near-death experience for me to do so. Do yourself a favor and figure it out while you're healthy.
Good lesson and good words. Matt, thank you very much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it.
Okay, back in the studio real quick. My thanks to Matt Yaloff and Tim Kawakami, of course, for their time. Thank you to Lou Pellegrino and everybody at Digital Media. Please check out these podcasts on Apple Podcast as well as Stitcher and SoundCloud. Previous guest, Tom Rinaldi of ESPN. We had a sports media roundtable with Chad Finn of the Boston Globe and Andrew Buchholz of Awful Announcing, and Ian Eagle of CBS Sports. We are up to episode 130. The reviews and ratings have been unbelievable, and the numbers have been far better than I ever expected for this little sports media podcast, so thank you very much. All right, again, for Lou Pellegrino, for the people at Digital Media, for everybody at Sports Illustrated, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.